right. So this is not exactly the title as announced. This is part of ongoing work funded by Unilever India and involving these people from Kemenj, Geeta, who is now at Unilever, Hindustan Unilever Limited, and Sunil, who is at Leeds, I understand.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Sorry?
There are other people who will be announced later.
Yeah, and also I'm not in chemical engineering, appearances to the contrary notwithstanding. I'm in physics. Okay.
There's nothing wrong with chemical engineering.
Yeah, but it's just, you know, I can't claim an affiliation that isn't mine. Okay, well, this is an introduction that's hardly needed. We actually were funded because Unilever was trying to understand what happens to surfactant things when you put in particles and you have a lamellar phase with particles and defects if you can make it rigid. And so hence all these words like personal wash bars and so forth. But the idea basically is to try to understand how defects control the mechanical properties of mesophases. And so really, this part of the talk is primarily about some experiments we're doing. I should also emphasize that we is being used in a sort of managerial sense. I haven't actually done any experiments myself. So I should make that very clear. The initial experiments by Geeta, there are several other names which will come along. Oh, why do I look at this? Yeah, sorry. Not used to this yet. And so much of what I say will just be about the experiments, but the motivation is somehow to try to, you know, eventually to come up with mesoscale models in which the dynamics of defects can be included in such a way as to make serious predictions for the mechanical properties. I won't say we've made spectacular progress in this direction. One of the motivations actually was work by some people at IIT Bombay and at Hindustan Unilever, where they took lamellar, but not L-alpha, L-beta phases, I believe, and added particles, poorly characterized, quite big particles, clay particles of various sorts. And they found that at a relatively small volume fraction, there was a big enhancement of the elastic modulus. So we were very interested to know if there's really some kind of percolation of some structures going on. And this is one of the things that Hindustan Unilever and we wanted to try to understand better. Okay, so basically that started the work off, and I'll tell you about rheological measurements, images of the structures, the effects of particles, a very crude attempt to estimate the elastic properties based on these defect network pictures that we see, how the structures and the mechanical properties evolve under shear, and then conclusion. After that, Kumaran will tell you about simulations of two different types that primarily he and his students have been doing, but also we, the rest of us, have been involved in at some level. The work is done on this kind of rheometer with all the standard geometries, and you measure G prime, G double prime, also steady flow measurements, various things. The visualization was done initially in a separate shear cell designed for this purpose, where you could shear the top plate back and forth and look at it through cross polars and look at the images. I should say one other thing, which is that this work is published in European Physical Journal a few years ago. More work is still in preparation. But since this is not a journal that's widely read in this country, I thought it's actually worth pointing out, particularly with Fred in the audience, that that is actually published. We also have a setup in which the rheometer itself has a little attachment on the side, a microscope that, so you have a transparent top plate attached to the upper thing of the rheometer, technical word, and you can peer in to the sample through a microscope and do polarizing microscopy and get images of structures while you're doing mechanical measurements. Okay, the studies were on lamellar phases of SLES, mainly, with rather big particles dispersed in it. So the particles really don't move around except to the extent that you shear the material. And the initial work, what we did was we wanted to understand how shear treatment, you start with a sample, you know, as quenched, it's full of defects, and you measure the mechanical properties, and it shows some kind of rigidity. And then what you want to understand is, as you shear treat it slowly, how do those properties evolve? So you shear treat for a while, then stop, measure the mechanical properties, shear treat again, and so forth. So you can then plot storage and loss moduli as a function of time, but it's to be understood that it's done in this particular way, where you actually stop flow and measure it and restart.
What's the next show with particles?
excuse me, big particles, 10 to 20 microns.
Spherical.
Mainly PS, I forget now what the other ones.
Silica
and polystyrene. Thank you.
Well, the malar phase with the characteristic length is 50.
This is not a, yeah, these are fairly concentrated. I mean, these are not dilute lamellar phases where undulation forces and so forth. These are things where the layer spacings are about 70 angstroms. Okay. 50, 70. Anyway, yeah.
The particles are bigger than the.
The particles, of course, are far bigger than the interlamellar spacing. Yeah. Yeah. There's no, I mean, they're just sort of stuffed in there. The sorts of measurements we get, I mean, this is not a very exciting looking picture, but basically what it shows is if you shear ever very slowly at 2 per second, you start out with a sample as prepared, which is a mess. You make a measurement at a fixed reference frequency of 1 hertz, and you find the G prime has a value of about 1,000 pascals. Shear treat for a bit. At a low shear rate, what you find is the modulus goes down. There's something going on here, which I'll come to later. If you shear treat at a higher shear rate, let us say 25 or 50, the modulus doesn't go down as effectively. Okay? So the idea somehow is that an initial shearing does reduce the modulus a bit, but then after a while, the higher the applied shear rate of shear treatment, the more the long time value of the modulus is. There's lots of ups and downs in this, which I'll talk about presently.
What would happen if you had no particles in there at all?
Oh, this is without particles. So right now, it's all without particles. The with particle stuff I'll come to in a second. So I mean, the first thing basically is that, as was pointed out in one of the early talks with Ralph, you were talking mostly about pneumatics or smectics also, I don't remember. Yeah. The point is basically that even though a perfectly aligned smectic will flow in a layer-over-layer geometry, a smectic full of defects acts kind of like a squishy solid. And it's because of the defects. And this is G double prime, which shows a similar but not as pronounced trend. There's nothing very noteworthy in this particular picture. If you look at G prime, this is supposed to be G prime, even though the picture doesn't make it very clear. G prime of omega, okay, here is what you do. Initially, you measure G prime of omega, and you get this. Shear treat for 240 seconds at that steady shear rate. Stop and measure, you get this. Shear treat further, and then stop and measure, you get this, and still further, you get this. So the idea is that the whole G prime curve itself decreases. The overall scale of the modulus goes down under shear treatment. Not entirely surprising. And G double prime shows a similar trend, and G double prime in general in all these things shows this roughly root omega behavior at large frequencies, whereas the large frequency behavior of G prime is less clear in this picture. Okay, and so notice the modulus comes down from, this is G prime, from over 1,000 to a few hundred and can be brought down further by steady and slow shear treatment. Ah, so this is the one that doesn't come out nicely, damn.
G prime was always larger than G double prime, is that okay?
Yes, over this range of treatments studied. This is what the modulus labels have come out as a function of time does when you add particles relative to without particles. So essentially what happens is when you add particles, you find that the modulus is larger and broadly, until a fairly long time, stays appreciably larger than that without particles. Okay. So, excuse me, now that's G double prime. Similar but less pronounced trend. One of the things we were interested in, you remember I mentioned that in L betas, when you put in particles, there seems to be a concentration at which things build up abruptly. At least in these L alphas, we don't see that. And we've been unable ever to reproduce, even in L betas, this rather striking effect that the IIT Bombay and Unilever people saw, which is of some kind of percolation of something, particles, defects, it's not clear what. We haven't been able to see it. It's entirely possible that we were too careful in preparing our samples. We went to considerable lengths to make sure that we got rid of air bubbles and so forth, whereas they just sort of stirred the stuff in and measured. So I don't know. Yes?
You said they were working with clay particles?
They were working with marble chips, various things. I mean, so the behavior they saw for a couple of different kinds of particles seemed the same, but I'm not sure how careful they were in preparing it, or whether there's a difference between their L-beta and ours, and so forth. They were using K-palmitate L-beta phases. We used something.
That also.
Yeah, so we weren't able to reproduce that.
A big problem here is air bubbles getting entrained.
Yeah. So what? Right. So what we did was to prepare the thing in the isotropic, disperse the particles in the isotropic phase and cool on the stage on the rheometer into the lamellar phase.
Is
you should think of L-beta as a solid with a small shear modulus for sliding layers over layers. So it's a 3D solid, but in one direction it's weak.
No, it's solid in plane.
In plane it's a solid, and there is also, you know, you could wonder about whether you can have a phase where it's in plane solid but freely sliding. In practice, I think it's got a smaller shear modulus for sliding the layers over the layers, but each layer is solid-like.
Just a comment that with some of the clays, even in just straight organic solvents, you can get a gel.
Right. Right. Yeah, the control that they did in glycerol didn't show the same effects. It seemed to be important. Thank you. Yeah, it seemed to be of high viscosity. Glycerol or silicone oil? I don't remember what they did. Yeah.
So these ones you've pre-sheared at one reciprocal second. Is that what that means?
Yes.
What is the interaction between particles and
What is it? So far as we can tell, I'll show you some pictures later. It appears that it forms a layer around that. Basically, at least up to one or two layers, there's some homeotropic alignment on the surface of the particle for spherical silica or PS particles.
And you haven't repeated their protocol of preparing?
We don't know their protocol of preparing.
It's very difficult to repeat.
Yeah, because I think it may not have been all that precise a way of preparing it. It may also, I think it's still worth looking for phenomena of that type, because it might turn out there's some structure that does percolate. I'll show you. No, I don't think this is. I think this thing is wrong. I don't think it's pre-treated. I think that's just a stray.
Omega
must be one hertz. I think this is just a typo. Sorry.
Yeah. So this anchoring, this is critical to what you see.
We don't know because we haven't been. Typically, on solid surfaces, you find homeotropic alignment for these things. I think. But the anchoring on the particle is very important, as you'll see from. If you're asking about the type of anchoring, I don't know. I don't think we've been able to vary the type of anchoring.
Just any anchoring.
So there's some interesting. The physics of the anchoring is of interest. Essentially the conclusions of the straight rheometry is just that, as you would all expect, the defected lamellar phases have an elastic modulus, and that there are two competing processes. I think this is what's important, that you saw that if you shear it at high shear rates, then the modulus goes up at long times. And in fact, the long time sort of terminal value of the modulus, to the extent that you can assign a constant value at long times, is substantially larger if you shear it at high shear rates. We have studies going on now on the details of this, but we can mention them briefly, but they're still under Unilever wraps. And notice one thing. If you looked at those G double prime curves, it's probably worth going back to. You notice that they had this sort of. This is now sort of no longer very surprising to anybody, but they were flat or even rising at low frequencies. And everybody knows, of course, that a sensible G double prime doesn't do that. It goes through zero at zero frequency. But this in this subfield has now become accepted normal behavior. Either there is a turnover and it's going to go through zero eventually, or these materials are just soft glassy matter, and maybe they're aging, so maybe the longest time in the problem is something that just goes on getting bigger the longer you wait. Right? You know the G double prime should go through zero. It doesn't, and there's at least two possible explanations. One is this Solich-Cates notion, and the other is there is a big time and it'll eventually turn over. We'll have more to say about that when Kumaran shows you the simulations also. Yeah.
This shear rate effect, you said that it's distinguished. Slow rate versus fast rate.
Right.
You're going to tell us
a little bit about what we think is going on.
Okay.
Yeah. Towards the end of my part of the presentation. Okay. And so, there's some of this physics of working in of defects, and that physics must be different for these systems from what it is for pneumatics. The type of defect is different, the effect of shear in pneumatics. In pneumatics, you have one nice way of getting in defects, namely tumbling. Here it's something else, and we'll suggest what it might be. And you know, adding particles does, of course, reinforce the elastic modulus, and a fairly small concentration of particles produces them. It's not enough to sell soap. I mean, it's still, at best, 1,000 Pascal. Okay, so you can't put that in a packet and put it on the supermarket shelves.
That's what Unilever wants to do with it?
Actually, it's not clear, but I think the motivation really was those experiments by the Bombay people, which saw this. They're interested in general on, you know, defects in and their role in processing. Right? I mean, that's the broader interest. I think the idea that you can actually make a solid soap by this is not there. But it's true that all cheap soaps consist of mesophase with lots of filler. And the filler is, you know, silica, clay, things of that sort.
Because of modules you see in the regime is still linear, with what inflection
I'll have to go back to that one. You want me to go back to that one?
Well, no, just tell it.
I mean, there's a broad, relatively smooth trend without any abrupt onset at some special.
But what is the function?
Well, I mean, you know, it's not as though the range of increase and the range of volume fractions is not so large that you would fit a great function to it. Over some region, I'm sure you can fit it as linear, roughly. It's not clear that it's. I mean, there is a little bit of upward curvature, so there may be interaction effects between two particles. I guess that's your point, right? If it's linear, it's just that each particle is contributing something. It's like an Einstein calculation of viscosity. It's not quite linear. It is more curved upwards than linear. So there are interparticle interaction effects of a sort that we don't really understand. But I'll say something about that when I show you the structure pictures.
The data that you showed, in which you looked over time and you saw this decrease in the modulus, one with particles. And what was the volume fraction of the particles in that case? I'm sure you mentioned it, but where was it on the curve that you showed?
I have to go back. I actually don't remember. The volume fraction was. Sorry. It was a few percent. It may not have been 2 or 3%, I thought. Was it 5?
Five was sort of just above gamma.
Right, okay. It's been a while since I talked about it. Okay, so you know the question is, how can we understand what's going on? So what we did at that stage was a separate setup where we had the sample between two glass slides. By the way, in the rheometer as well as here, the gap thickness that we looked at typically was about 100 microns. Okay, so this is a separate setup. This is not a rheometer. This is something separately fabricated where you have a motor that slides a top plate back and forth, top glass plate back and forth, and the sample is in here. And you look at it through a polarizing microscope. So you send in light from below, polarize, analyzer here in the cross geometry. And the whole thing is, well, standard setup. You can record the information on a monitor, on a VCR and so forth, and look at individual images to analyze them further. And in this setup, we looked at shear rates from 0.1 to 50 inverse seconds and large strain amplitudes. The idea is, you know, over some part of it, basically, you're trying to produce more or less steady shear. So it goes like this, and back, and back. And the question is, what did we see? Well, this is just details of the view. And just to remind you, you know that if the sample, if it is actually aligned like this perfectly, then if you look at it through cross polarizers, it's isotropic in the plane, and therefore you'll see nothing. It'll be black. So if you do see something, it means the alignment is disturbed. And initially, when you just slop the stuff in there and look at it, it's full of defects with various kinds of brushy textures. This is just the stuff as prepared. You haven't shear treated, you haven't done anything to it. And what's really pretty is what happens when you shear treat it, in this particular case, at a fairly high shear rate for about a minute. What you get is not a picture that looks like a polydomain smectic. What it looks like is a substantially aligned smectic, that's the dark regions, with this rather dazzling network of things, of line-like defects.
What's the flow direction here?
You're looking at it from the top.
What's the scale?
Yeah, but it's to the right.
100 microns. One of the other pictures has that. This. The line thicknesses are tens of microns. I don't remember the scale bar on this one. There are some other pictures of the scale bar. Sorry? Why are you doing that? Yes. It gets more oriented later. Yeah, it gets much more oriented later. Okay. And the thing to note is that these are classical lamellar phase defects. They're line defects, which I'll say a little bit more later. But depending on how much of a purist you are, you'd either call these oily streaks or arrays of focal conic domains. The point is that, in a coarse sense, these line defects probably are large Burgers vector dislocations, but with a lot of internal structure, which I'll try to say a little bit about. Okay? So the point, the first message is that, at least in these surfactant systems, I don't know about copolymers, the kind of structure you get, I should really, at this point, I think the reference is not in that thing, so similar things on cholesterics were seen by the Penn group. Science, about that same year, I think. I do not remember the reference, but it's there in the paper. This is Wade, Slavinsky, many people. I forget the list of authors. So they actually saw this in cholesterics before we saw it in the lamellars. Okay? Yes?
The common shearing ECV in the cementing phase shows very similar.
I see. Okay. Right, which presumably is also what we have here. Yeah, so you start out with aligned layers or start out with a mess and shear line? What do you do? You start out with, Right, okay. So if you like, the point is that the mechanical properties that we're seeing are a consequence of this rather pretty defect network. Okay, and if you like, the theorist's job then is to understand how this defect network gives you the observed mechanical properties.
In what sense does cholesteric
layer similar? Look, a cholesteric in a macroscopic sense is a layered material. So its elasticity and topological defects are essentially those of a smectic. And the differences were that their line defects that they saw were all elementary, I think.
Like tau lines, lambda lines, that kind of
thing? No, the dislocations, or oily streaks, in other words, is what they saw in the cholesteric as well. And the story they have is very similar to what we then found. This is the prettiest picture. I guess the others are less dazzling.
What is the orientation of the polarizer and analyzer here?
I think polarizer this way, analyzer this way, I think. Reasonably sure. Could be the other. Yeah, I'm fairly sure it's that. Okay? So having marveled at that picture, we can go on to. And then what happens if you shear it for a little longer is all that stuff disappears. There are some faint defect lines. You shear it for about a quarter of an hour. Then there's a residue of defect lines. And but you know, by and large, the thing becomes featureless. Okay. This is, if you add particles, however, well, this is, if you add particles, then initially, of course, you've got a similar defect-ridden, messy configuration. But if you shear for a while, for a
scale, are we actually seeing particles now?
These are very big particles. They're 20 micron particles.
Oh, so we're really big.
Okay. Some of these are particles with what presumably is layer-wrapped alignment around them.
So those oily streaks are enormous.
They're really fat oily streaks, yeah. Very large Burgers vector. One thing, of course, is, I don't know, presumably this applies. In smectics, dislocations do tend to clump because the core energy of a dislocation is linear in the Burgers vector. And so it's a competition between that and some kind of confinement energy. So you have a tendency. This is Williams and Kleiman, 19-something. So it's possible that's why you get large Burgers vector objects here. I'll come in a minute to what these things are. But the thing to note right now is just that, first of all, you're getting some, on this time scale, you're getting some alignment that someone was asking for. Yeah, but the defect lines are still there, and basically you go on shearing, the defects don't go away because the particles are present. But a much nicer picture of that, skip that for a moment, and just to convince you that the defect structure and the G prime somehow have something to do with each other, we plotted the transmitted intensity, which is a measure of how defected it is in a crude way, because if it were perfectly aligned, it would just be black, and the G prime as a function of time, and you can see they roughly track each other. That's the G prime. And that's the defect. That's the transmitted intensity. Okay. Yes.
Without particles.
That is without particles. That last one is without particles. Will this cooperate? Just a moment. Just one moment. For some reason, that last frame doesn't like to load properly. Just give me a minute. We'll get there. Not cooperating, is it? Hello? What's that? It's getting there. Yeah, okay, we're fine now. I can stop panicking. there. So now, this is what happens under shear treatment. Okay, here, this is a scale bar that's 100 microns. Okay. This is what happens under shear treatment. The time scales are not in the picture. I think this last one is 12 minutes. Okay. Start from this, go to this defect network, and then eventually go to almost nothing. With particles, you can see very clearly that what happens instead is the defect lines hang about, and shear treatment at the same time results in a structure still full of line defects, anchored, as you can see, on clusters of particles. The particles tend to cluster, and the defects get hung up on them. And it's, so I mean, the story in that sense is really very similar to what the Penn group said in cholesterics.
Can you say anything about the ordering in the z direction here? Are the
which this is the
Are the particles forming sheets? Are they
the really particles seem to form clumps. They seem to form just clumps,
but
not very structured.
They have the same sort of structure in the z direction here.
Yeah, I mean, there's no discernible, there's no obvious. Yeah, if you change, there's no special structure that we could discern by trying to focus at different depths in the shear cell.
So that seems to be in place.
How about the in the upper series without particles?
Yeah.
In this plane, it looks like the defect network is pretty isotropic. And I guess, do you know anything about, is it that the defects are confined to a plane?
No, they're not. You see, one thing, it's important to note that if they were just edge-like defects, okay, remember, if you have defects that lie only in this plane, they are dislocation lines with an edge character, right? Out of plane, they have a screw character. Those screw ones seem to be essential because otherwise, see, if you've got just a planar structure, unless it's connected from one level to the next, you won't measure an elastic modulus when you do this, right? And actually, if you look around, you will see, you can see the lines that are in focus for a bit and then get less focused. So it, the defect network is very three-dimensional.
Ralph, you remember, didn't Kleinmann say, you talked a little bit about whether the relevant dislocations were edge or screw, and I thought he settled on the conclusion that the elasticity was coming largely from screw dislocations.
The rheology, I mean, there's this recent paper by them on the rheology and trying to get the gamma dot to the minus 2/5 and things of that sort. And that is based on an analysis of screw dislocations. But if you want to just get the small amplitude pseudo-elastic behavior, you clearly need a network that extends in both directions because, I mean, I guess conceivably if you had one screw dislocation or a bunch of screw dislocations anchored at the top and bottom plates, you could get that. But if you want to think of the bulk of it as an elastic material, you need a network with a mixed character. Otherwise, you won't get elasticity.
You mentioned that the thickness of the sample was between 100 and 200 microns,
yeah,
which is the same size.
Well, this is yeah.
Your bar. So I'm
right.
That, you know, particle bridging across the gap when there's clusters.
There could be, but in fact, the clusters do not. You can check just by, you know, varying the focus. The clusters don't directly connect from top to bottom. That again, you can verify just by inspection.
What's the connection with screw dislocations?
No, the idea is just that if this network, these are essentially large Burgers vector dislocation lines. So if they extend in this direction, then they are screw-like by definition, right? A dislocation line whose tangent has a component along the Burgers vector has a partially screw character. So it's clear if you want a three-dimensional network of oily streak lines, then they have to have mixed character. The standard things that are called oily streaks, and I'll come to that in a moment, is just if you have two edge dislocations of large but opposite and not necessarily equal Burgers vector, then you might expect they'd come together, but you might expect there are barriers to them actually coalescing. Okay, so you get something which here is like, you know, Burgers vector 17 and here is Burgers vector minus 8 or something. So the thing as a whole has a fat core.
Do you want to draw this?
Comes up. That's why it's because I'm so bad at drawing it, I'm using Kumanen's drawings. Yes.
In the figure of the modules versus times, as you shear at long times, the data for particles and no particles actually merge.
Eventually they do. So eventually this thing does appear to go away, but it's a little preparation dependent.
You have no pictures of the ones that actually go away.
Yeah, but they will look. They look like this, but with particle clumps. We don't have. Huh? But that one still has lines in it. Lots of defect lines in it. Most of them are along the flow. So I don't have a picture which is clear, but with particles.
So if you don't have defect lines, but you have clumps of defects there.
Clumps of, if you had clumps of particles.
Clumps of particles doesn't couple to modules, you're saying.
But again, you know, they would if they were anchor, they made a network across the sample, right? They'd have to actually anchor on the walls before you can get that.
Is it like 2%, 5%?
Probably what happens is once these clumps form, the clumps themselves don't deform. I mean, if you want them to contribute to elasticity, you'd have to have a somewhat deformable clump and preferably attached to the walls in some way. That doesn't appear to be the case. Probably if you put in even more particles at some point, you would get that.
Well, I'm worried about the flow of lamella between clumps because they actually have these curved surfaces.
Sure.
And if it's squeezing
squeezing the point really is that, you know, a big clump just excludes the lamellar phase material, that's all. And so.
But the shear between two curved surfaces is not the same as between curved.
True. Okay, so.
And so if you have for 5% or something, you have a combination of shear and compression.
Yeah, so you could get something. I mean, we haven't seen anything. We haven't looked at very much larger volume fractions. And
50%
should be enough. Okay, but we don't see anything very dramatic. There is still a residual modulus, even at long times, which depends on how much.
The data points overlap.
Right, more or less. So apparently the particles aren't contributing once they clump.
Because as you said, it should be a linear.
One thing to note, though. At the moment, we're comparing pictures taken in one gadget with rheometry in another gadget. So, you know, you do have to worry a little bit about what happens in the rheometer. Yeah.
Well, based on your comments of the interaction, even of just purely wedge lines, if you have a whole bunch of those in their interaction, then that will contribute to the modulus. You wouldn't need to have a 3D network. It's related to what Michael was saying.
Possibly. I mean, yeah, it's possible that just that, you know, when you move it, the distortions interact with each other, even though there isn't a line. Yes, it's possible. Okay, so let me just to remind you, topological defects in smectics, that's an edge dislocation deliberately drawn with large Burgers vectors, so you can see that it consists of a disclination-anti-disclination pair. That's an edge dislocation whose line comes out of the screen at you. And you can imagine pairs of them which come together, but then there's barriers, kinetic or something, that prevent them from coalescing, in which case you have an object with a large core whose local character here is of a dislocation of one type and there of another, but looked at on a large scale, of course, it's just an edge dislocation whose Burgers vector is that minus that, but it has, you know, a lot of texture in here. And these are known to be quite common in smectics, and you would expect these things to produce lines all over the place if you looked at them through cross-polars. So they're called oily streaks because they look that way. If you look at, okay, let me just remind you of, I need a better picture of this for focal conics. 1 minute tutorial on focal conics. If you have a material that's layered and wants to keep its layer spacing fixed at all costs, then what are the things you can do? Well, one of the simple things you can do is a concentric, either spherical or cylindrical wrapping of layers. Such a structure has a singular line here, right, where the layering fails. You can imagine a toroidal wrapping. So this line is a circle, and there's another line in here where the layering fails, where, you know, if you extend the layering from here, clearly they abut. And so in this simple toroidal thing, you've got a circle and a line. You can now generalize it, and I won't try to draw it. You can generalize it to where you have one singular line being an ellipse and the other being a hyperbola. Okay, and that's the general focal conic, which you can look up in the Zen and Pro. Now, the thing to note is it has been argued that this sort of structure, the oily streak structure that I just described, could break up along its length into focal conics. If the saddle's play modulus is such as to favor negative Gaussian curvature. Now, I don't think I can draw the pictures to convince you of that, but the idea is that these lines don't have to just be sort of pristine dislocation lines, in turn consisting of pairs of disclination lines, but could break up into more complicated things with this focal conic structure all along. And if you look at our pictures, this one, you can see, Sorry? Yeah, the focus is a little bit, I mean, it's, I should probably shrink it a little bit to give you a more visible, yeah. You can see these, from where I sit, actually, it's not so clear, is the only trouble. It's not just the light, it's also the focus. It's too grainy right now. But if you look hard at it, you will see there are little objects in here which are characteristic of what you see under polarizing microscopy for focal conics. So these lines, so if you look at various images, we seem to see both kinds. We seem to see focal domains as well as classical oily streaks.
Striation? So there are a few little clovers that you're
pointing. Yes, it's the clovers that I'm talking. So I got worried because from where I'm standing, I just see pixels. So hopefully you can see clovers from where you're sitting. Okay.
Striations, are those understood as well? That is,
these lines themselves or what? Or which striations?
The other lines have got nearly periodic striations.
For the striations along the lines, that's actually the breakup of the discrimination line into focal domains along the line. Okay, so that's the idea. That is that it actually pinches off into focal domains.
There are a few, like three point out, that actually look like these clover pictures.
Yeah.
The rest of them, you just see periodic dark lines all the way along the line.
I think if you make small clovers, they're going to look like periodic.
Yeah, if you have lots and lots of small clovers will look more or less
there.
But there's more. There's also, there's instability. What is, there's this...
calculation that showing the instability
versus... isn't really a calculation as such. I mean, there are calculations, Kliman and Boltenhagen, I think, have a calculation of the circumstances under which discrimination lines become unstable to the formation of focal domains, which...
Is it essentially covered by the Gaussian curvature?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you seeing that some of those are oily streaks and some of those are focal conics?
In this picture, it looks like they're all focal conics, but there are some other pictures, other images, where you seem to see the others. I mean, pure oily streaks in the sense of a large Burgers vector dislocation line consisting of abutting of two, in turn, each resolved as a pair of disclination lines. I mean, without much of a modulation. But there are also other modulatory instabilities of the oily streak line. So there's a bunch of different things. I mean, from the macroscopic point of view, these are all, they are line defects whose coarse grain structure is at large distances that of a large Burgers vector dislocation. But the internal structure is important. And, you know, we make some attempt to assess the, now I have to go way forward, completely lost.
Those lines that you're showing in your focal conics, the hyperbola itself has to close, right?
Hyperbolas don't close by definition.
Right, but the effect line has to end somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, who knows where. No. There are other focal domains and so forth around, right? So, I mean, I'm...
In your picture, there was the focal conics look like a little compact object.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I'm actually not very good at analyzing these things and showing you where the hyperbolae and where the ellipses are. But if you close in on a
do
given...
they connect to each other, or do they...
What happens if you have an array of...
Well, actually, they can heal themselves, you know, because, I mean, you mentioned that this is what you get if it's at all costs, it has the same layer space.
Yeah.
But there is some...
There'll be some small regions where you actually have to violate the fixed layer spacing. I'll try to show you a picture of that also presently. Okay. Forget about onions. This talk is not about onions. Okay. Okay. No, you're asking about. I was mentioning that there are other instabilities of these oily streak things, including an undulation along the line, as distinct from this. So this is an attempt to show far better than I could do the two kinds of pictures. In one case, you've actually got focal conics. So you're sort of looking along the length of the line. In one case, it's broken up into these focal domains, and the other. It's lines with a possible wiggling. These are the two sort of typical things that happen. So the you can get striations along the line even without a decomposition to focal conics.
Why would that undulation make black?
Presumably the orientation will vary along the line, right? Almost any modulation is going to give you some optical contrast. But not the ones you see in the plane.
Not in the
plane. If it undulates out of plane, then yes. Well, there is this rather elaborate calculation of the energetics of these focal domains based on the idea that the contribution comes from the edge dislocation energy and a bending energy of the layers. And I'll not go through that in significant detail. The basic idea is that if you have a whole array of them, it turns out there are regions where the layer spacing won't be able to actually maintain its equilibrium value. And it turns out the major contribution, if you have a network of these, to the elastic energy comes from those regions, because you pay this layer compression energy cost. So if you try to estimate, here's the idea. Supposing you have a network of these lines, okay, something, some sort of a mesh, three-dimensionally. So you have lines, let's say you have a typical mesh size L and a typical line tension T. And you would like to estimate the elastic constant of this network based on this idea. Then you would clearly like an estimate of this. And we just essentially lifting a calculation by Boltenhagen and Kleiman, it turns out the compressional contribution to the energy per unit length turns out to be set by the layer compression modulus times a length scale squared, which in the case of a single line would just be the sample size, but in a network with mesh size L will be screened at the mesh scale, times a factor which depends in great detail and very severely, unfortunately, on the eccentricity of the ellipses. And as a result, you can sort of play around and get almost any value you want. But we made the best estimate we could of these numbers. And if B is 10 to the 5 Pascal and your network has a 50 micron mesh size, then you get G prime of order a few hundred to 1,000 Pascal. I mean, I have to admit this is not a detailed calculation. Most unfortunately, it depends on the fifth power of things that we don't have much control over. But it's what we've been able to do. Okay.
So
yes?
H again is what?
If you had just, you know, if you had an unbounded structure with one oily streak line.
So the reason, I guess the reason I'm confused is that you said that the compression energy dominated the energy and the compression was screened beyond some length. So I'm wondering why the sample size comes into the answer.
No, the energy, okay, so come back there. This is if it's not screened, okay?
Okay.
Now, if you have a network with a mesh size L, then our argument is that that sample thickness should be replaced by the mesh scale. And so that is what we use to, this is an estimate of the energy per unit length of one such line in a sample, in a big sample of size H.
But it comes from the far field.
Yeah. So it's reduced from just the layer compression modulus by factors having to do with the size of these regions where there is an appreciable layer spacing deformation. That is small. And as a result, you don't get an elastic shear modulus of order exactly equal to the layer compression modulus, but down by a geometrical factor which is small compared to unity. Okay. So, I mean, that essentially ends our description of the experiments. I'll just spend maybe a few minutes on possible mechanisms for producing defects in these things. So it looks like what you have is that a steadily sheared smectic is a sort of non-trivial rheological material whose properties are determined by the strain rate. Okay, so you have a non-equilibrium steady state with a bunch of defects in there. And that's the thing whose properties you're measuring. So in fact, one point of view would be to say that you should just measure the properties in the flowing state and not stop it and do mechanical measurements. You know, you could take a different point of view. It's just a sort of complicated viscous material with internal fluctuations from the defects and so forth. And there appear to be two things at work, shearing slowly, which gets rid of defects, and shearing more rapidly, which actually works in defects. Okay. And so the question is, what's the mechanism?
Do you have visualization data? You had shown early that the modulus would go down and then go back up. Do you actually see an increase in the defect density?
You see an increase in the defect density in pictures that we don't have, which are taken with the microscope on the rheometer. Although the pretty pictures I showed were with a separate shear cell. Mm-hmm. But yes.
So if it seems to have some implications for the rheology. I'm still confused. That is, you estimated the modulus as a line tension over L squared.
Line tension over L squared, yes.
On the previous graph.
Yes.
So, as if I just had a bunch of lines and some energy associated with them.
Yeah.
But again, is the energy concentrated near the core? Should I just think of the.
Yes.
Okay, so it's simple to think of them as lines if the energy really is concentrated near the core. But then you have an expression for the energy of a line, which involves the system size.
Yeah, so clearly the energy of a single line is not entirely.
It's really in the core field.
Okay, so I need to think more about that. Fair point.
In these oily streets, as you separate two nodes, mm-hmm. do you expect that tension is constant, like it is in other
variables? If the oily streak structure doesn't change, right, if the dislocation content doesn't change, then yes. There's another point I should make, which we don't mention here, which is that there seems to be more than one kind of network. If you look at the network the Penn group had in the cholesterics, then it anneals very rapidly. It anneals by detachment and retraction of lines. Okay, you've got this defect network, and you sort of, if you work it, the lines detach, and you can see these nice movies that Martin Zapatoki once showed us. So the line actually shrinking away, and you can estimate how fast it should shrink and so forth. In our stuff, we basically never, maybe once, see a retraction event.
Are there topological restrictions on when that can happen? You've got a Burgers vector with an obvious.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, in their case, it looks like pairing of elementary. If you have an oily streak, it's actually a balanced thing, plus one and minus one, then its net dislocation content is zero. So that line isn't truly a topological defect, right? And it can disappear. In our case, it doesn't appear to be the case, and maybe for that reason, you don't see retraction. But what you see instead, it sort of fades away, which is not a very nice thing to say. I mean, I don't know what's happening. What does fades away mean? Don't really know. It's fairly clear that once you have large Burgers vector objects, there's no particular reason to expect them to be perfectly balanced. Yeah, sorry?
If the number of positive and negative is not quite the same,
yeah.
But if initially it's large, you would see a larger one. Because it starts.
The core would shrink as they start to, you know, as it starts internally to get to cancel off as much as it can. Maybe that's what's happening.
But then you have to be left over with a little bit of resident charge.
Right. But then the shear, you know, would bring these lines to each other. You know, I don't know. So I'm not sure. Yes. The one question we can try to answer is, what is the mechanism at work which pushes defects into this stuff? And it seems like the most a likely candidate is the classical undulational instability, but produced here not because you're explicitly dilating the sample, but because when you're shearing, if things aren't quite aligned or there's some region where the layering is slightly off axis, a shearing can produce dilation in some directions. Okay?
It's going to be like the kingpin.
So this is the same story? So should I not?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure yet. Because we're not seeing dilation. That's what.
Mm-hmm. But you see spontaneously induced undulations for some reason. So anyway, I guess we'll hear your talk. Yeah. Okay, just to remind you of the undulational instability, recall that if you take a lamellar sample and dilate it like this, then it tries to keep the layer spacing fixed, and the way it can do that without changing the number of layers, which you know requires moving material in, is to undulate. So you fill a larger region with the same number of layers. That geometrically is the reason for the undulation instability, and the maths is as follows. Look at now imagine you're doing this actually by dilating, and I'll explain why it might happen in shear. You've got the elastic energy, which is the full strain tensor for layer dilation, which has this nonlinear piece, and the layer bending energy. So imagine dilating and imposing a fixed dilation d, which is du over dz. Okay, then the cross term you get from here, dzu times grad perp u squared, will simply be the average dzu, which is the dilation, times grad perp u squared, and note with a minus sign. So what that means is that this object, treated as an effective energy for in-plane undulations of the layers, is unstable over a band of wave vectors given by the balance between these two terms. Layer bending energy says, no, you can't bend too much. This says, I want to bend. And it's this. It's like a negative surface tension for the layers. Okay, and clearly, the instability takes place if wave number is smaller than this quantity, which goes to the square root of the dilation. So the idea is.
What you're doing now is dilating an undulated base state?
No. Right now, this is classical undulation instability. I'm just giving you a 2-minute tutorial on that. That is, if you dilate a smectic, then the elastic energy for in plane. Sorry?
I got lost in the tutorial, I guess.
No. So this is nothing new. Right now, I'm just saying that if you just took a smectic and dilated it, then the energy cost of in plane undulations now has a term which favors undulations. Right?
So it's undulated and undulates.
Yeah, it's undulates because it's dilated. I dilate it by imposing a non-zero du over dz.
And that's a constant.
And that's a constant, right? So the cross term from here will give you du over dz times grad per q squared with a minus sign for the Eulerian strain tensor.
Relative to the dilated base state.
Relative to the dilated base state. Yeah. But see, the thing is, the dilated base state doesn't vary along the xy plane. So in that sense, if you're looking only at variations in the xy plane, then it's the dilation is involved only in setting this coefficient. Right? So this is classical Helfrich-Yoho undulation instability. So there's a wave number below which the instability will happen, which goes to the square root of the dilation times root b over k. But actually, this would suggest that what sets the so that means that if your sample is not large enough, you don't see the dilation, the undulational instability, right? However, you might think that it should therefore the the dilation. I've done this right. I need to use the board. Sorry. Okay. So you've got dilation times wave number perp squared, right? And so b times dilation times wave number perp squared. Yeah. So the crossover wave number goes as root b d over k. So you might expect that if the sample is smaller than 1 upon this length, and 1 upon this object, then you won't see the instability. Actually, the thing that turns out to control it is not the lateral width. The dominant thing that controls it is the vertical thickness. The reason is essentially the funny nature of smectic elasticity. If you have a sample of thickness h, then if the thickness h is smaller than, let me just first state the result. You've got an, if you had a sample unbounded in the z direction, but a finite extent L perp in the in-plane direction, then the crossover length is that. Okay. If you have a sample of thickness h this way, then it will turn out that actually what controls it is what you get by replacing this by, let's do this right. Let me write it this way. Excuse me. There, I think I've got it right now. Yeah, so the crossover thickness turns out to be this way. Yeah, I've got it. Have I got it right? I think I've got it right. Yes. I got my units right. K over B is a length squared, yes. Okay, yeah. And the reason essentially is that if your sample, supposing you have undulations of a certain wavelength, then, okay, let's think of a simpler situation. Supposing you had a boundary which you undulated at a certain wavelength, and that penetrates into the medium, not a distance of order that wavelength, but a distance of order that wavelength squared divided by the lambda parameter, the layer spacing. So it penetrates a far deeper distance. So if you put that in, you will find that really the minimum dilation in a basically the in-plane sample size is not the thing that dominantly cuts off the instability. It's the sample thickness. And so the minimum dilation required in order to produce an instability in a sample of thickness h scales as 1 over h. I think this is also classical. This is not our stuff. All right. Now, how would you get an undulation instability in shear? The idea somehow is this. You're shearing this stuff, and say there's a normal component to the stress also proportional to the shear stress, either intrinsically or because of defects, because of misalignment. So the idea basically is that you've got this stuff, and it's not absolutely perfectly aligned. So when you shear it, in some regions, the extensional axis has a component normal to the local layers. Okay, and so you can imagine that there's an effective dilation, which is the extensional part of the stress divided by the layer compression modulus. And so you could imagine getting something of this sort, where the shear rate required to produce undulations and therefore eventually defects can be quite small if your sample is moderately thick. So if you put in numbers for our system, obviously you don't know what this fudge factor A is, which says how much of your shearing is going into extending the layers. But you put in some number that's substantially smaller than one, but not minute, and you get that's the standard number that's substantially smaller than one and not minute. It's 10%. Of course, I was just. Then you get a sort of the required shear rates will be of the order of a few inverse seconds. And so you could imagine maybe that what happens, you've got this material, you're shearing it, undulation instability happens, and when it sort of grows nonlinear, you get lots of defects worked in there.
And if you replace the particle, so you can do those numbers?
What number? You're saying we put in the elastic?
Well, page H would change because now it's going to be space between particles, and G would change because one particle with the compression between particles.
You might think the presence of particles would suppress the formation of defects. But if you've stuffed particles in there, you've got lots of defects already in the process of stuffing particles in. So, you know.
Well, the question of the upturn. You start with some defects and you keep shearing, and the question is, as you keep shearing, does it go up?
Don't know. I can't claim to have a detailed enough theory to answer that question. Because the trouble is, first of all, the particle-filled state isn't a well-oriented state. It's a mess, right? You already have lots of defects in there.
So you can shear it.
But of course, if you appreciate it enough, then you get rid of the particles. You know, they aggregate out, right? They sort of. So then you know, then you have vast regions which are just particle free. If you appreciate it enough, if you enter that region where the moduli are small, if you don't, then you've actually got a defect network already, as a result of an interplay between putting in particles and slow pre-shearing. Now, if you take the particle-filled thing and pre-shear it fast, then you produce more defects on top of the defects. This is just imagine a nearly perfect smectic on a sample size with sample thickness H. Yeah. The point is that we can't claim to have a theory. The idea was just that if you're shearing like this, you might expect that in some regions at least you end up dilating. That's all we're trying to say. Okay. Inclined slightly, maybe the wall is not perfect. I mean, there's so many. The thing is that they're so prone to this happening that. But this is just a fudge factor. We don't know what A is really, right? That's why I said 10% or something. Some fraction of the shearing actually goes into dilating. Yeah.
Scaling was H was check
experimental. That we have. Well, we have data on that, but I guess we haven't yet got Unilever's permission to talk about that data.
In short, yes.
In short, yes. In short, not for the undulation instability as such, but for the appearance of defects, the appearance of you know messy rheology starting from nearly perfect rheology.
Yes.
Yes. That's work, unfortunately. But, you know, maybe we'll try to get Unilever to permit us to talk about it before we leave here or something. Let's see. Yes. You know, this scaling for the. No, but that's only in our stuff, right? Have you seen it elsewhere?
No, I haven't seen it.
Yeah. Okay, so that's more or less what I have to say, and now the remaining 31 transparencies will be with Kumaran. So each transparency has fairly low content, you see, so it's okay. All right, so this is the story, really, that you know these, if you shear treat a large tropic lamellar phase, what you get is a defect network, not a bunch of domains in the sense of, you know, actual grains with the grain boundaries between them, and the elasticity seems to be a result of that defect network, and that there is some mechanism which makes them more defective and therefore more, you know, kind of, it produces defects. It's a kind of work hardening of smectics that seems to be at work here, and that particles seem to be able to stabilize this defect network from decay. And that's more or less what I have to say.
You want to show the hexagonal phase?
You want to show those? Yeah, I guess, okay, if you like, I can show those. I thought you were going to show those. Well, just by contrast, these are pictures of a columnar hexagonal lyotropic phase. And there you can see you really do have things that you would identify as domains, you know, broad regions of different orientation with reasonably well-defined boundaries between them, which, as you shear, eventually go into more of a classical hexagonal phase texture with these striations, which are the hexagonal phase version of the undulation instability. So the columns are coarsely aligned this way, but they have undulations on them which appear as striations. So in the hexagonal phase, the elasticity seems to be a result more of domains abutting each other, like a form of domains, rather than a network of lines, just by contrast.
These are much more rigid.
Yeah, and they, of course, you know, you can hardly, I mean, they're pretty thick. Yes.
So the time dependence will be in the second part, I will not ask questions. How you just show this nice decay of modulus as you keep shaping the frame rate long and long and
yeah.
Longer. Which presumably tells you something about the kinetics of annihilation.
It does, but I can't say we have a great theory of it. We have some simulation pictures of defects and so forth. One thing is clear, it's not the total strain. I mean, the one statement we can make about the time dependence is that shearing slowly for a long time and shearing fast for a short time are not the same thing. It's not the integrated strain rate that's responsible.
But what is experimental time dependence? Is like one of the
how does the modulus decay under steady shear?
Well, it seems to depend upon the shear itself.
No, he's saying what's the time? What's the form of the time dependence? It's not very clean, is the problem. That's why I'm reluctant to.
Your data was very nice.
Not all that. I mean, a lot of it is quite messy, right? If you look at the initial transmit.
When I showed G prime as a function of frequency at different shear, it looked like a nice shift.
Right, but if you look at just G prime at some fixed frequency as a function of time, for the lowest shear rates, it goes down. The thing is that there's an initial very rapid decrease, which is faster than exponential. Okay. Because an exponential at short times is just linear. The initial decrease is sort of more steep than that, and then there's a persistent bit which sticks around, and you can't quite clean up all the defects. I mean, that's roughly what it looks like. So
you don't want to build a constant frequency. You want to superimpose those curves. There is a shift.
Yeah, there's a shift. You shifted the curves, and they all collapse.
Oh, I forgot to talk about the data collapse.
Yeah.
Did I didn't. Okay. If you look at G, it's going to be a. Okay, I can try to find it. Why not? Is that right? That no, it's here. If you take this G prime data, unfortunately not the G double prime, I don't know why, this is G double prime. If you take this G prime data, you can actually collapse it all onto one curve that is essentially G prime of omega over some reference G prime. Versus omega over some reference omega. That's what's really plotted here.
And you're adjusting G ref or you're adjusting both?
You have to adjust both. And so they both depend on shear treatment. They both go down. So there's a sort of scale G prime. You can think of this some sort of a elastic modulus. Maybe it's a coarsening mesh or a weakening mesh in some way. This reference G goes down, this reference omega goes down. So if you take all the curves of different shear treatment, you can basically collapse them onto one curve. It's as though there's...
You have lots of those G and omega as a function of time at different shear rates, because that's what...
That was much earlier, right, yeah.
Well, here it wasn't reference, it was about frequency.
You know, the shift factors.
This was at fixed frequency, it's not the same.
Oh, what do you want? You want...
Well, those, your shift factors.
Oh, yeah, that's there in the paper, but not in the... I understand what you're saying. Those go down with time. In... It's the thing is that, okay, I can show you that later rather than try to hunt for it now, okay?
And there is no well-defined power rule as you follow, as well as my question.
With four data points, what am I going to fit? I mean, that's the real thing, right? I mean, it's not as though we have some sort of spectacular decades of data. Okay, so now I should find my way back to where I left off so that Kumaran can that continuity is not violated. Yeah, so that... Yeah. Okay, other questions? I should. Okay.
It's all yours. Let's take page down. Actually, you just tap on that little touch bar over there. Oh, you want?
I hope so. Okay. I'm going to show you all the simulations that we've done. Okay, we had a bunch of wishes and which are sort of hard to reconcile. We wanted anisotropic properties, alignment under shear, variation of loss in storage moduli, annealing introduction of defects, flow around particles, flow through complex geometries. The separation scales makes it difficult to achieve any of them in any single simulation. The kinds of things that we've been doing, I'll only talk about the last two, that is the lattice Boltzmann and the macroscopic continuum models. We also did these microscopic lattice Monte Carlo. It turns out they're hopeless. I mean, you can get only a few molecules into anything. We did continuum Monte Carlo simulations. They don't give you dynamics, and it turns out dynamics are crucial for these simulations. Lattice Boltzmann, what I'll show you are two-dimensional, involving a few layers, which answer questions about undulations and the like. And the macroscopic continuum model, we haven't gotten very far with it in the sense that we haven't been able to include defects so far. But for well-aligned layers, it seems to give proper results. And I'll show you a few results. Once again, I haven't gotten Unilever's permission for the rest, which involve integrating it into CFD codes. So just does everyone know lattice Boltzmann, or should I give a brief introduction, how it's done? OK. Basically, you know that if you have an ideal gas of particles, then at the individual particle level, they're all moving around, you know, in some random fashion. But if you look at length scales large compared to the particle size of the mean free path, you can effectively describe it by the average fields, the mass momentum energy fields, and these follow, for example, the Navier-Stokes equations. Okay, so of course it's difficult to simulate a gas of particles because you need to go to 10 power 23 particles to get anything that resembles a macroscopic scale. So then the question is, what is the minimal model that is simple enough to resolve at the microscopic scale, which will still give you the correct dynamical behavior at the macroscopic scale? And it turns out that if you put particles on a lattice and let them move with discrete directions of motion and discrete velocities, you can still get the Navier-Stokes equations at the macroscopic level. And of course, there's the other way to do it, and is to just solve the macroscopic equations of motion using some kind of a boundary element method or something like that. This has certain advantages in that it's what is called a cellular automaton model, so it's easier to parallelize, for one thing. And the other advantage that industrially it's useful because you can more easily represent complex geometries, okay? Because you're straight away going to a smaller lattice size to get the equivalent of what you would get in a finite element model. So if you have geometries like squares and circles, this is not advantageous. But if you have intricate geometries with nozzles and things like that, then it becomes more advantageous because you're going to smaller scale to get realistic behavior anyway. Okay, so you define a distribution function, which essentially gives you the distribution of particles along each of these lattice vectors. And the macroscopic fields are defined as averages of this distribution function over all directions. This is the density field. The momentum field is the distribution function times the velocity in each direction. And the velocity has integral values. It's 0 or 1. So it's easy to simulate, and you can get similar expression for the stress in terms of the distribution Excuse function. Me. Yeah.
In this method, if you have inertia,
yeah,
and you show that there is no residual when you compare it to Navier-Stokes,
for certain values of the relaxation time, yeah, you have to choose the relaxation types properly. Yeah. Then you can show Galilean invariance, right? Yeah. Okay. And so the way it works is you go through streaming, collision, and redistribution steps. So first, in the streaming step, you propagate all the distribution function in the direction of their velocity vector. Time interval is by definition 1. Velocity is by definition 1. In the collision step, all the particles incident on a node collide. And in the redistribution step, they are redistributed in the outward direction according to certain rules which satisfy mass, momentum, energy conservation. So essentially, the distribution function at position x plus ei, where ei is the unit vector in the direction of the velocity at time t plus 1, is equal to what is incident on the distribution function plus something else. And that something else is essentially a relaxation term, the distribution function minus its equilibrium value divided by a relaxation time. And you define the equilibrium value in such a way that all the moments are satisfied. This is sort of parallel to what is our kinetic theory of gases. And you can show that the above scheme correctly reproduces macroscopic Navier-Stokes equations with the kinematic viscosity, which is related to the relaxation time. Okay, so. What we did for a lamellar phase was to put in a free energy functional. Okay. This is the usual free energy functional which is used. So if you try to minimize this with R being negative, then you'll get an ordered state with layers of wavelength 2 pi by Q naught. Okay? And since we need not just the total density, but also the order parameter, which is the difference in densities, so you define an equivalent set of equations for the order parameter field. And let me just say that this has sort of been checked for various kinds of things. For the separation of two fluids, for example, it gives you correctly the time hyperbolic concentration profile that you would expect and so on. Okay, so.
Within a model of this sort, would it be possible to make the local, or something like the local microscopic viscosity depend upon the order parameter? Could you take your parameters in lattice Boltzmann and make them functions of C, I guess, in such a way variations?
Okay, in principle it is, because all you do is you make the relaxation time a function of the order parameter. Whether that introduces some instabilities or not, I don't know, the numerical code. But, because the relaxation time is a parameter, right? Mm-hmm. So you can always make it a function of the order parameter. So that's, in principle, it's possible. Okay.
So you're modeling two components at the same time?
Yes, there's a concentration field. Essentially what you're doing is you're identifying the layers with the position where the concentration field goes through zero.
And both components have the same mobility, or you can do it with different mobility, local velocities?
You can make, the mobility is a function of concentration. Okay, that's...
But mobility is...
Or viscosity, a function of concentration. Okay, at this level, there is no real problem. The problem comes in when you put in noise fluctuations. Okay, and then there's a difficulty because your dissipative terms are now concentration dependent. So your noise correlations have to be somehow adjusted so that the fluctuation dissipation theorem is satisfied.
Okay, Michael, your question is just what there is. You can think of one of the components as the solvent. As the total density, okay, and the other as the
density difference,
as density difference, the concentration, and the concentration has a diffusivity or a mobility, which you can control. If you're not, and then if you want to make it depend on the order parameter, as he said, that's a complication, but it can be done.
I'm sort of thinking of how I would generalize this to block a polynomial, where you could have A and B have different local viscosity.
That's essentially Wes asked, and that can be done.
Because there are two things. There is an isotropy in mobility, because your mobility across a perpendicular is different.
Yeah. No, but
that's not necessarily only due to the field, but also due to some kind of local structure. And in addition, A and B have different properties.
Okay, the orientation will come in through gradients of the concentration field. Right?
Well, that would be the driving force, but not the friction.
Yeah, so you...
The friction itself may be different.
No, he's saying that the way that the orientation would enter, if you wanted to make the friction depend on orientation, you'd have to put in a frictional damping which depends on gradients of the order
parameter. Gradients of the order parameter field.
Can you give me a little bit of details on how you implement the free energy for the other parameter, how you degrade it, and what K0 is in all this? How they calculate? K0 is a fixed parameter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's defined in lattice units, basically.
Okay. So the gradient is over instantaneous configurations or over the distribution or?
Sorry?
How do you compute the gradients when you do the simulation?
The gradients are calculated.
How do you implement? Let's see, in the lattice Boltzmann, if I remember correctly, at each node you have local equilibrium given by the Boltzmann distribution at that point.
Yeah, not the Boltzmann distributions. It's something else that is. It's usually a polynomial form that is assumed. Yeah.
So how do you handle the gradients? That's what I'm asking. I just don't know.
Maybe you should just explain how does it, maybe you can explain how the free energy enters the whole thing. No, I mean.
So the concentration equation will essentially be is equal to some
E del square
in this case. Right, so in the momentum equation, what you're going to have is partial TV minus, you'll have a term that is reciprocal to this, which is del psi, delta f by delta psi, is equal to eta del square V. Okay, so this considers forcing in the momentum equation. So this feeds into the equation for the total distribution function.
That I understand, but the first one, how do you handle the first, the equation for the other parameter? How do you solve for psi?
Maybe you can explain just these.
Let me see. If,
arrow, just put down arrow.
I mean, see the when you solve for the distribution function of the Boltzmann equation, you automatically get terms that go as eta del square V, right?
Yeah.
So the same thing, you'll get eta d del square delta f del psi when you solve for equations for the concentration field. You'll automatically get that.
Because it's conserved, right?
Yeah.
But you have higher order derivatives.
And that comes out of this free energy term here.
So in the simulation, so I don't know if this is a related question. The simulation is psi a fluctuating field that has values of, let's say, 0 and 1 at different points? It depends on, or is it some sort of ensemble average used in?
No, it's a fluctuating field, and where it.
It just depends on the location.
Yeah, so as a function of distance, I mean, if I calculate psi, for example, it'll fluctuate something like this. Okay, and this distance is going to be 2 pi by Q naught.
Okay. Mesh size is much smaller.
Mesh size is much smaller than that.
So you have this little variable G at each node, which is the representation of C, just the way you add a little variable.
Right, F, which is the representation of total density. Total density, yeah. And you identify layers with these positions where it goes through 0.
At each point, C is not necessarily 0 and 1, it could be intermediate 1, like 0.05 or something.
Oh, yeah. It could be any value.
And then you just integrate forward.
Yeah, well, I mean, you get the total field. It's a field which is a function of position, and from that you back out the lines where it is equal to 0, and those are identified with the layers. Okay, I mean, that is once again not universal. You could identify the maximum or the minimum, but some periodic structure you'd identify. I mean, for us, 0 is the most convenient thing.
But at each step, you basically, next time step, you're effectively integrating this equation.
Oh, yeah.
Using this rule of inflow and outflow, basically simulates integration step.
Yeah, you evaluate it at each integration step.
And you're saying that this procedure that you're doing, updating distribution functions, amounts to, in an indirect way, solving
these two equations.
I mean, one comment, maybe. At the moment, we're looking at only psi going to minus psi invariant things, and in that sense, you can think of the zero set as a surfactant bilayer and both sides as water or something.
Okay, so this is shear alignment. essentially you quench it into a lamellar phase and you get something that looks like this. These are once again lines where psi is equal to zero. And you apply velocities positive and negative on top and below, and it sort of aligns. And one thing we see in all of these simulations, which we don't see in experiments, is that there are always intermediate times where there is an alignment along some 45-degree angle. Okay, and that sort of coincides with an increase in viscosity, okay, as you go through this.
Before you apply shear, what happens with your picture if you just, run it for a long, long time without
Shear? Yeah, I mean, you cannot run it very long, but if you run it on this order of magnitude, hundreds of thousands of steps, nothing happens.
And so it still looks the same as the first one?
Yes, because there's no noise in this.
This is two dimensions.
There's two dimensions.
Right? They don't help it any. It has to be only under the sort of systematic forces.
Yeah. There's in two dimensions.
But the
Sorry?
You need
that to satisfy fluctuation in the space.
There's no noise?
In this, there's no noise, yeah. Well, the idea is that...
How can you satisfy this fluctuation without having...
Well, the temperature is very small.
Sorry, what is the question?
How can you satisfy fluctuation dissipation if there's no noise?
I mean, the answer, Fred, is this is like simulating the equations, the mean field equations of motion without noise.
Yeah.
Noise. Right. I mean, you know, after all, you do it for a fluid, for example.
There's a random process involving the lattice Boltzmann itself. You're saying that the partial differential equations that it's equivalent to don't have.
It's not a random process. That's not right to say it's a random process. There isn't a stochastic step in it at all. There are these things that you call distribution functions, which you usually calculate. What you're doing is you're calculating the fluctuation averaged hydrodynamic equations.
But you pick the exit state according to the distribution, don't you? After a collision, these guys are distributed according to a certain probability distribution.
You don't have particle coordinates which you update according to the distribution. You only have the distribution function.
You have only the distribution function.
So it's completely deterministic.
Yes.
There is no.
It's not the same as the lattice gas atomic.
Yeah, it's not the same as the lattice gas. Yeah.
Okay. There you actually would have noise in effect, but there are other difficulties with that.
So it really is just like simulating the Boltzmann equation for absolute gas during simulating the equation for distribution function.
Yes.
But it doesn't relax to equilibrium, so this is really something worries you.
Yes, it doesn't relax to equilibrium. Yes. That's because. Yeah, it will never relax. Because you need to shear it in order to get it to relax, right? Yeah. If you don't have fluctuations, noise fluctuations, it's not going to relax.
Michael, for example, supposing you did mean field dynamics of some model, you know, solving a PDE, take those PDEs and solve them without noise. That's a mean field description of the dynamics, and it will get stuck in the nearest metastable stable state. So in
well, that's my question is, why are there metastable states in the system? Why is it in
There's no stochastic step.
There are
no thermal fluctuations.
There's
nothing
that
really is
which lets you escape from
zero. It's a downhill dynamics, the coarse grained effective dynamics. This is essentially downhill apart from hydrodynamic streaming effects.
No, that part I understand. But there's a lot of metastable minima in the equation that I wasn't aware of. I thought it would automatically straighten the boundaries.
The coarse grain dynamics is equal to those equations on the blackboard, which contain no noise.
So you're saying that the first picture is a ground state, is a true ground state?
It's not a true ground state. It's a true metastable state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It'll evolve to some defect stuck state. It won't stay in that state.
Well, that's my question.
It won't stay in this state,
but it'll take a long, long time before it gets to any.
And it will reach a final state which is full of defects also.
I'll show you some states which are full of defects.
I'm sure there will be defects, but that's my question.
It's not that state.
Yeah, I'll show you states where there are defects.
So I'm interested in the way in which the structure is coupled to the flow. So can you describe what the velocity field would look like that goes along with the bottom right picture?
Mm-hmm.
Will there be...
It'll be nearly constant here.
Okay.
Yeah, because there's no resistance in those regions.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Excuse me, in your model, sorry to interrupt you so much.
but I'm looking at the second equation. Mm-hmm. So the net effect of this free energy is somewhat to renormalize the pressure. So that term is like the elastic stress tensor.
Yes. Yes, it'll be pressure-like except for the higher-order gradients in the distribution function. Okay, if it were just a two-fluid equilibrium, it would be pressure-like. Okay, in this case, there are higher-order gradients, okay? So you don't get exactly a pressure. There is a transverse component also.
Sorry to interrupt, just one comment, which is if you take the psi grad, a del grad psi del and plug in a density wave with an amplitude and phase and keep the amplitude constant, then you will get smelting elasticity out of it also.
Yeah.
So all of that is in there.
Yeah.
We need to clarify. We believe that the elastic gradient should be in the aligned layers and very little gradient in the misaligned stuff rather than what you said. So there'd be very low viscosity in the aligned material, so that's what's just
at the top and bottom, right?
Yeah, right.
No, because those are the gradients.
The velocity is maximum on the top layer and the bottom layer.
Right.
No, but the gradients, he's saying, the gradients will be large in the layered regions. In the
Yeah, the gradients are large in the layered regions.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you were kind of sketching something on the flat.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's... This is faster alignment. And we sort of did simulations around a particle. We didn't end up with very much, except that... This is sort of in a periodic domain, and you can see that if you have a particle here, there's another one here, and there's sort of some defect here, and it sort of aligns around it. Okay, but this is not really representative of what's happening in our system because we have only very few layers here over the particle scale. Okay, but
how do you put a particle in?
Sorry?
How do you put the particle in?
You adjust the distribution function at the wall such that there's no normal velocity.
Okay.
And this is rheometry. This is the viscosity as a function of time as it goes through various configurations. Okay. So initially, you can see there's a decrease, and you'll see an increase in viscosity as it assumes these kinds of configurations. Okay. The viscosity sort of increases as it goes through these configurations.
Wait, here you're getting this 45-degree alignment before any boundary line.
Yes.
What did you change?
Reynolds number. It's higher. Yeah.
What's the total? What kinds of total strains are applied in this, over this range?
There's a steady strain.
The total integrated strain is the total strain is how much?
I'm wondering. So what's this, you apply a strain much greater than one when you have that 45 degree alignment?
Oh yeah. Sure. And then it sort of settles down at late time when the system starts to align. Okay, you can see that as the system starts to align, the viscosity comes down. There's still some residual strain left. We tried storage and loss moduli.
Could you just go back,
because
those pictures were flashing so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So the viscosity here is sort of a running log.
Yeah, it's a running log.
And
it's
the last point is what the picture corresponds to.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is
2D runs.
All of this so far is
2D. Everything is 2D.
The Reynolds numbers for these runs were actually a little large, right?
Yes.
Like order one.
Or order one.
That's
for numerical reasons, but we still expect viscous effects to be dominant even when the Reynolds numbers are order one or two. So,
the solution is going now for much smaller.
Yeah.
Okay. How is the Reynolds number defined?
Based upon the kinematic. Gap thickness, velocity, and. Kinematic viscosity. So the way you'd normally do it is to sort of put an oscillatory strain and see what the response is in phase and out of phase. First cut, what we did was try to apply a step strain and determine the evolution of the stress. Okay, so if you apply a step strain, then the stress will be a constant for a Hookean solid. For Newtonian liquid, it will instantaneously come back down. And for a viscoelastic fluid, it's going to go something like this. And what we did was to determine the storage and loss moduli from the inverse Fourier transform of a step strain. Okay.
Just the Fourier transform.
Okay, so this is the one such run. of the initial configuration, that is the stuck configuration that I showed you initially. Okay, we've done it for others as well. And this is the result that you get from a step strain. And you can sort of back out G prime and G double prime from this, okay, as well as G star. I should note that the low frequency results are not really reliable because they sort of depend upon the length of time to which you're taking the step strain. Okay, but it's not reliable at a region after this downward curvature takes place. Okay, so we fit it in such a way that G prime and G double prime give you the correct linear results at very low frequencies, linear and quadratic results at very low frequencies. But the time scale for the fitting is long enough that you do see this feature is real. Okay, whether it goes down linearly or not is something that we cannot make out from the simulations.
That's G double prime, right? My eyesight is.
Yes, this is G double prime, and it shows a loss peak. Okay, so that was real from the simulations. But
what are the two peaks? What's the high frequency? I don't understand.
No, I'm talking about the corresponding time scale for the high frequency level.
Yeah, I mean, you can see here, I mean, it comes something like this. Okay, I should point out one further thing, and that is that this region is not reliable, okay, because it's too high frequency.
Okay. To the right of that.
To the right of this, the data is not reliable because too high a frequency, and the frequency is higher than the time interval between two
and
two.
G double prime
is going up. G double prime is going up.
So the fact that here a peak is the integration.
The second peak, the bump at high frequencies is probably artificial, okay, because you're going to frequencies which are larger than the separation distance between two data points. Okay, it does, but the second peak is looks real because the data should fail only below this point. Okay, so this last peak seems to be real.
Is your initial configuration before you shear it stress free?
Yes.
But I mean, it's internally, it's full of defects.
Now, yeah. Of course.
I guess maybe that's not the same question, but I was just trying to see if there's any way of knowing whether the stress is actually going to decay to zero after the step deformation. That's what you assumed. You fit it with some tail going to zero.
Yeah. Yes.
But you're assuming you have a liquid.
Only for fitting the low frequency end.
Well, that's the fact for the cavity with the speed.
Yes.
Did you have a solid,
was it Kumaran, we took the same data just Fourier transformed and didn't fit it to anything. You'd still get broadly these features in the region in between your upper
yes,
and lower.
Yes, broadly between those two, you'd get the same data. And actually, you do see something that looks like an upturn in G double prime data and
right.
in
so
the experiment.
So the ones we saw were not the Fourier transform, they were fits to Fourier transform?
They were fits to Fourier transform. Which gave the correct behavior at very low and at very low and very high frequencies. Okay, so the intermediate region is probably correct. Okay. But
so are you fitting your GFT before you transform, or you're transforming GFT and then doing
it? Transforming GFT and then fitting it. Yeah. Okay, it has to have the correct analytical behavior, right, at very low and very high frequencies. So.
If G prime could be flat for all we know.
Yes, so we have to run it for much longer times, which is what we're doing right now.
But I mean, one thing you can say with confidence, right? I mean, supposing you don't look at the loss peak, you look at the region where G prime is roughly flat and G double prime goes down and then up. That is exactly what you'd get if you Fourier transform the data.
Yeah. Right? See, G prime is roughly flat here.
Yeah. Okay.
As you go through a region where.
I don't know. That's one thing I didn't understand. So, do we get the peak even if we don't do the fitting? That is the peak at least partly a result of requiring G double prime to go as omega at low frequencies? Or will you get it if you just Fourier transform the data and kept the reasonability? That's the only thing I don't know about.
Okay, the peak is, I don't know about the peak, but I know that the trough is probably real.
The minimum and
the minimum is.
Yeah.
Is real, okay. Whether it goes through a maximum and then comes back down, that I don't know. Okay. That we'll know only if we do the runs for much longer, which we're trying to do right now. Okay. But, I mean, the experiments show there's a trough in some regions at least, okay, for G Dolphin. Okay. Now what happens here is something I don't know. If it were a liquid, it has to come down. Okay. And that is to some extent a philosophical question about whether it's a liquid or solid, but I don't want to get into that.
Have you done the step strain of high alignment?
Or yeah, then
intermediate stages?
Yeah, we've got reams of data on that actually. do you have that in this computer?
The
other G prime feed all time data?
Other G prime, no, probably not. No,
things shift downwards.
LBM or?
In LBM. LBM. Okay. G prime comes down. I mean, G prime reduces dramatically as you shear align it.
Do either of those G double prime peaks move?
G double prime peaks. I'll check and let you know.
Just the valley.
Yeah. Let me look at the thesis and I'll get that to you. Yeah, I'll get that to you sometime soon. The problem is that I've not been able to log into my computer for many days, so there's an old canned talk that I'm giving. We also looked at undulation instability of layers, and here what you do is you want to dilate a layer, dilate the system so that you have some equilibrium spacing of layers, and you want to increase the box size, and then shear it, and then see if it buckles. And increasing the box size is sort of difficult, so what we did was to change the parameters in the free energy functional such that you start off with a system which is at equilibrium with 5 layers, and then you instantaneously change the free energy parameters so that the equilibrium configuration would like to have 9 layers instead. Okay. So that was our implementation of undulation. And these are pictures. If you have just perfectly aligned system, nothing happens, okay, because it is at equilibrium there. But if you have slight variations, and at this point when we start off, we 200,000 time steps, we change the free energy functional parameter instantaneously, this parameter Q0, in such a way that it would like to have 9 layers instead. And you can see that it buckles into some metastable configuration. And it never reaches a perfectly aligned state. This is in the absence of any applied stress. It reaches a final state where the layer separation is actually very well preserved throughout the system, okay, but it's still very disordered.
Maybe it's worth noting that this is the sort of configuration full of exclamations and no visible grain boundaries that
I'm confused about something. There's a theory by Kodama and Doi and one by Shiwa, where they actually look at the stability for your equation.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember right, there's an undulation instability at Q equals Q naught. So you really cannot stretch anything and it just battles immediately. Am I remembering this wrong?
So this is a block of polymer system.
But it's there free energy.
No, but that's a system where you shear it and it actually would like to thin.
They actually simulated this set of equations, call it block of polymer or whatever, but it was actually this equation. If I remember right, Shua had a zigzag line and the undulation line exactly vertical at Q0.
Well, is it because it's an infinite system? That is, if you put smack under infinitesimal tension in an infinite system, mm-hmm. it goes unstable immediately.
Mm-hmm.
This equation under a little bit of tension goes unstable, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's infinite. You do have to put it under a certain amount of tension before it undulates.
Yeah.
That's what I'm
mm-hmm.
confused about.
What's the finite size of it?
No, but he's put it under tension because what he said was he chose an initial number of layers, which was fewer than the required number of layers. Right? I mean, that's the way he did it. So that's putting it under tension. So I don't know, but what you're saying, he's saying something about the undulation instability sitting in at Q naught.
Right.
That certainly doesn't follow his metric hydrodynamics. It's along with instability. So I'm wondering if there's some copolymer feature that's been put in if the layers are.
But the analysis of those two papers is actually that equation.
Okay.
Undulation instability at Q naught in an infinite system.
Okay. In an infinite system at Q naught,
mm-hmm.
right, the undulation boundary is exactly at Q naught.
Undulation boundary
means what does that mean?
All modes at Q naught are unstable.
Meaning that for any R or any of your distance from
bifurcation point. Yeah. You would have a zigzag instability or non-linear instability for any q that's less than q0.
Right, but it's still the dominant, the fastest growing mode probably won't be, will be something else, not necessarily the one at q0. So I don't know which one you will see in the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a long wavelength instability, so you have a finite size system, and presumably it is possible that you don't see it for the system sizes that you I don't know. Is this something we've seen in 3 bit
QNOP?
Okay. So it sort of gets stuck at some state, but if you do it in the presence of shear, right, so what we did was we continued to apply shear on the system, and at some stage introduced change the free energy functional, and then you see that it goes through some intermediate state, and so the shear initially, so this buckling instability is initially introduced, and then it goes through a state where it is highly defected, but finally in the late stage the shear actually aligns the system back to its layered state. So in the end, you sort of get a perfectly aligned state.
Okay. The right number of layers?
Sorry, it's the correct number of layers, yeah.
Things went to the walls. I couldn't quite follow the progression.
Okay, the system size is too small to get any real disclination lines and stuff. Okay, so there's only a finite number of layers here. But you can see that this is the point at which it starts buckling, okay? And you get intermediate states that are highly defected. Okay. And so then it anneals like any defective state would, right? I mean, it aligns along some intermediate direction with the layers aligned along some intermediate direction, then it comes back to these intermediate states, and these defect lines, they sort of start going to the wall and joining up somewhere there. And in the end, at the end, it goes to the final state that you would expect to get, okay, with the correct number of layers. Okay, so, but
it's pairwise annihilation of these.
Yeah. Well, either it has to annihilate pairwise, or it has to go to the wall and go to the wall.
Hold on, I forgot the boundary condition on the top and bottom faces was periodic.
No, this was aligned at the walls.
It's aligned at hard walls.
Hard walls.
So the defects can actually leave.
Yeah, this.
The fact that we didn't expect this isn't necessarily relevant, but I'll say it anyway. So this was an experiment that we had, Karen and I had discussed as a way to produce controlled tape bends. What the idea was to produce an undulation and stability and then shear it and then watch the chevrons to form as a result of shear, which is obviously not what happens.
What is chevrons?
Are you shearing to the right?
Or are you
shearing to the left? Are you shearing to the left or to the right?
The top plate moves to the right and the bottom plate moves to the left.
Yeah. Okay. Because the annihilation here is totally distinct from what we see in the kingdoms.
But
the annihilation here is these, you know, point defects annihilating one another. That's not.
Right. I mean, still, but among other things you don't see here is that you never see a well-defined chevron. That is, you can get structures like in the kink bends where there's a tilt boundary with a width that's controlled by a competition between bending and compression.
Well, there were a few on the previous page. But the system is small. I think that.
Yeah, the system is small. Yeah.
You know, there's a couple where that are kind of bending, but there's only like maybe two or three that are kind of tilting over.
On that third,
you can
talk about that, like here.
Yeah, right there. Where they're all tilting together.
And then there's
parallel rows of those tilt boundaries.
And the bend is localized there, so it
isn't. How much shear strain is elapsing between each of these pictures, roughly, or in any of your time units?
No shear strain is.
I assume it's enormous, but.
Shear strain, you mean distance moved divided by the distance across? The Reynolds number is 1, and the kinematic viscosity was, it comes out of the Reynolds number, so it's roughly 1 per time unit.
Strain of 1
yeah.
per time unit?
Per time unit or per frame, yeah.
No, not per frame. I mean, these are in hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, I think you guys are thinking.
We're thinking the strain at one. Sorry.
No, the other thing probably is that these are fairly. Yeah, so in other words, these are rather fast flows compared
yes.
to
what yeah. the Yes. Okay. These are fast flows, and that's another reason why. You, yeah. Okay.
So that's just perhaps why it's so easy to create topological defects. You're
yes.
really.
Mm-hmm.
Well, please, no. I mean, there's something that actually we. Don't understand, right? Is that the defects are primarily created by the by this dilation and the undulation instability. Shear is annealing it out only too well here. We haven't yet isolated in this simulation a mechanism whereby shear produces defects. Okay, so you need some level of disturbance already in there.
Yeah, you need disturbance already in there.
Something
yeah.
which we don't have in this.
Why do the pictures look so similar?
Yeah,
if you're going for 1,000 strain units, how does one picture survive and almost be the same in the next?
It's perfect it's, slip at the boundary.
Yeah.
There's no anchoring.
Yeah, there's no anchoring at the boundary, and it's periodic in the flow.
Something just slips. Creates a slip layer.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right, so then
the relative strain, it's not, the, they have to look at the relative strain units, not the absolute units. You just took 2 points and see how it is.
The local strain is small.
I'm sorry, I'm actually confused. The velocity field satisfies no slip.
The velocity field at the wall satisfies no slip.
So it should have like the pattern at the wall.
Yes.
But what's the strain in the middle of the, you want, is the rate of strain in the middle of the sample anything like the rate of the macroscopic rate of strain, or is it slipping?
It has to be, yeah.
If you have this arrangement to shear it in the middle, would change the layer spacing, which would cost an enormous amount of energy.
What slips in all the parameter,
all the shear
parameter.
Will go at the top and the bottom, yeah.
The other parameter can sort of slip.
Yeah.
If it's parallel, you don't affect it by the advection.
But if
it's at an angle, you cannot do it. But at the moment that you start creating a large curvature, the Laplacian term kills it and smooths it out again. So there is slip of the other parameter,
yeah.
right, effectively, but mm-hmm. not at the velocity, I guess.
Right.
Oh, you're making a distinction because you imagine there's a large permeation?
Right. Locally.
Okay. Right, so that's another distinction. So we assume that there's no permeation at all in the black hole power systems.
Right. So sort of flow through contraction.
So
molecules are allowed to
regular layers.
Right, right.
Right.
That's right.
Can
you so in this model you have mass going moving through and the layer just
That's classical permeation.
Yeah, that's permeation. Yeah.
So that's actually something that you can see how the behavior changes as you vary that.
Right.
You can see different things. So
if you were to think about it, each of those things as individual molecules, they would be basically moving along the streamlines. The streamlines are mostly horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
But those huge shear structures.
I guess that's, can you control the permeation coefficient in this
yes.
model?
Yes.
Can you turn permeation off?
No. I don't know. There's only one diffusivity. Yeah, that's the problem.
By the Laplacian of DFD sign.
Right,
yeah.
So chocolate is more equilibrated. So you need to think a little bit more about.
Well, wouldn't the fluid flow by itself eventually equilibrate you? Do you really need.
To minimize the free energy, you need permeation.
Yeah.
See, if you really want to do it properly, equilibrated, you want to put in noises, satisfying filtration dissipation, and so forth. But
yeah.
Without that,
well, I guess what you're saying, I mean, if I have the fluid flow which responds to stresses, can't the thing relax by a pure advection? Just have the fluid flow carried around until the free energy is minimal.
I want to think about that.
Yeah, it's
advection only will not minimize the free energy.
Well, it's not.
Yeah.
It's no longer a purely dissipative model that goes straight downhill.
That's right.
But there's still some tendency for the fluid flow to go in the direction that lowers the energy because it's going to the stress tensor for the elastic stress.
It might actually not be as pathological as.
Not the free energy of psi. The fluid minimizes something because there's viscosity.
No, but the stress is
not the other parameter.
The stress is coming from psi in the momentum equation as well.
Right.
But that's a reversible contribution.
Except that if you now turn that equation into a Stokes equation and say the hydrodynamic velocity field is determined by those stresses via Hossain, and then put that into the first equation,
No, it will not, because grad side, if the psi is reversible, that's a reactive stress.
Okay, we can note out about this later.
It's noon.
There's only six slides.
Okay.
Oh, that's okay. We can discuss this after.
Watching the number,
I'm interested in this, but maybe we should show it another time.
Yeah, that's it.
It's
12:30.
Yeah.
It's half past midnight in India.
Yeah, I know.
My computer thinks it's in India.
We get all the questions out of the way during the process.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Let's see if there's an audience for this one.